It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Last week, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention passed new recommendations to delay hepatitis B vaccines for newborns. Previously, the CDC had recommended that all infants be immunized for the disease within 12 hours of birth.
The move is part of wider changes reflecting Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s vaccine skepticism and the reshaping of federal health policy.
How will new federal guidelines affect Wisconsin newborns? Dr. Jim Conway is professor of pediatrics in the divisions of infectious diseases and global pediatrics at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He serves as medical director for UW Health Immunization Programs. Dr. Conway, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning. Great to be back with you guys.
Before we get into the new guidelines, let's get some basics on hepatitis B. What is it? Why do we worry about it?
Yeah, hepatitis B is a viral infection that causes liver inflammation, liver damage, and is often a chronic infection, especially when it's acquired early in life. It leads to longstanding liver disease, cirrhosis, and is the most common cause of liver cancer. It's much more transmissible than other viruses that we think of in the same category, HIV and hepatitis C, which are much more unstable and much more brittle. Hepatitis B is a really sturdy virus. It can live on surfaces for up to a week, and so it's a major concern.
Up till these new guidelines, the recommendation had been, like we just said, hey, all infants soon after birth. What was behind that recommendation up till a week ago?
Yeah, the problem with hepatitis B is that people can live with it without a whole lot of symptoms and not be aware of it. It's very easily transmitted if somebody's got active hepatitis B at the time of delivery. About 85% of babies born to a mom who's got hepatitis B are going to end up infected, and about 90% of those are going to stay chronically infected, and those then lead to longstanding problems. It's very difficult to get everybody in for screening. About 15% of people routinely don't get screened for hepatitis B, and they can acquire the infection at any point. And so these chronic infections, while was tried to do it in a risk-based way with vaccine, just didn't work. And so eventually in 1991, we got to the point where we recommended universal vaccination for all newborns. And it's really been one of the major successes of immunization programs.
Right. That takes us to the new guidelines. Moving back, if I'm reading it correctly, Dr. Conway, to a risk-based approach saying, hey, well, if the mom has hepatitis B, then yes, let's vaccinate right away. Otherwise, no, not right away. When the mother's negative for hepatitis B, the phrase when and if they should get a vaccine comes up in the new guidelines. What changes here?
Yeah, I mean, everything. This is really, sort of putting babies and young children at risk in a lot of different ways. You know, obviously, if we don't know everybody's status when they're being born, it's the safest thing is to just give every kid the vaccine so they're protected immediately. You know, the other problem is that then it gives people the idea that these are an optional vaccine and then leaves people potentially in the position where they're making decisions that are unfortunately misinformed, because about half of the kids that ended up infected in this country by the age of 10 actually acquired it after they were born. There's a lot of other ways, when we think about kids getting scratched or bitten at school, it can even be transmitted by people sharing toothbrushes inadvertently. So it's a very easy virus to acquire if you're around people with chronic disease. But the real risk is that, the likelihood of a chronic infection, if you're born to somebody with Hep B that doesn't know it, is quite high. And so this universal safety net really has gotten us into a great position over these last 40 years.
Yeah, with that transmissibility issue, one of the arguments from members of the committee that made this decision was hepatitis B, they say, primarily a sexually transmitted disease. It can be transmitted sexually, but it sounds like you're saying that's not the only vector. That's not the only way it's going to potentially be exposed to infants.
Exactly. I think obviously we know with the opiate epidemic, HIV and hepatitis C and hepatitis B are being more readily transmitted, both sexually and with needle use in older individuals. But hepatitis B, I think, has been lumped together probably inappropriately with those others in a way that is detrimental to the discussion. Because like I said, it can live on surfaces for up to 7 days. You don't really need a big dose of it to get infected. And people that are infected are actually shedding in large amounts. This is one of the viruses that you can acquire from saliva from other individuals. That doesn't seem to be the case with HIV and hepatitis C. So while it is sexually transmitted, it's also transmitted in a lot of other ways that unfortunately can lead to longstanding problems for people that are infected.
We're talking about a key federal committee no longer recommending all babies receive hepatitis B vaccines within half a day of birth. Dr. Jim Conway is with us, medical director for UW Health Immunization Programs. Dr. Conway, the committee making this decision, what is the significance here? How important is this this recommendation unit for our vaccine policy and practice in this country?
Well, traditionally, the ACIP has been responsible for harmonizing the recommendations from all the other professional medical groups and making a recommendation then to the CDC that sets what we have come to consider as sort of the routine recommendations and the routine immunization policy. You know, it's been an area of both pride and trust in our public health system for many years that we were able to kind of come up with these harmonized recommendations. I think people need to realize that, you know, there have always in the background been recommendations from the American Academy of Pediatrics, American Academy of Family Physicians. Most of these medical groups, you know, make recommendations. And, you know, currently it looks like we're going to probably end up depending on those recommendations as being more evidence-based and more based on science. I think the problem here with this current recommendation is that there hasn't been any new science or new publications or new discoveries that would make us at all concerned about the safety of these vaccines. And there's certainly nothing in the epidemiology and the public health that would make us feel like hepatitis B is no longer a concern. You know, quite the contrary, this same committee a couple of years ago made very strong recommendations that we actually need to do better on immunizing older adults because, you know, these birth doses only came in routinely in the 80s and became public policy in early 1991. And so we've got lots of older adults that are walking around that actually missed out on this particular vaccine. And that's one of the groups where we're seeing rising rates of hepatitis B, again, because of the opiate epidemic and other issues. So this is a major linchpin in our public health programs. And it's unfortunate if they're not really looking at the science in the way that we've become used to.
Bringing things home to Wisconsin, as a state, we have relatively low levels of vaccinations for things like MMR, the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. Are you concerned that with this change in guidelines from the feds, that hepatitis B vaccination could move in that same direction in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, Rob. I mean, we're certainly concerned with anything that undercuts the reliability of the information that people are seeing, as well as anything that undermines the confidence in vaccines. You know, one of the things we all have to recognize for providers and patients is that, you know, there's a lot of vaccines and it's complicated science. And so we fortunately have trustworthy organizations that try to sift through that and make these kinds of recommendations so that basically every kid, every person in our state gets an equal opportunity to be protected against diseases that can disable and kill them. And so, you know, we really want people to sort of establish trust with their providers, but also understand that there are organizations that, you know, they can trust that are going to continue to do this. And we're hoping, you know, that at both the state level and at the national level, that people will listen to these reliable organizations and understand that the science clearly tells us that these are valuable interventions that do make life better for everybody.
Dr. Conway, you mentioned there are a fair amount of vaccines out there. And I think for many parents, they might think, hey, maybe I'm not anti-vaccine across the board, but it does feel like a lot. Is it worth revisiting our vaccine schedules and saying, hey, maybe are we doing some that aren't needed anymore, that the science doesn't match up with anymore, and we can maybe pare back that schedule a little? What do you say to that parent who's at least puzzled by the number of vaccines out there?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think one of the things we need to remember is, you know, when there's a lot of disease, it makes it easy to make a decision to implement a vaccine program. The harder but almost more important part is to maintain that while those diseases still circulate globally and can easily be reintroduced. And obviously, that's what we're seeing with this measles outbreak. We've now got whooping cough outbreaks starting up again down in the southern United States. You know, we're going to potentially have one of the worst flu seasons ever as we see flu virus coming in from outside the country. And so I think we need to recognize these things are all still out there, and really maintaining protection is going to be the most important way to get to the point where we can eliminate or eradicate these. You know, we've certainly pulled back on some vaccines. Many people my age all got a smallpox vaccine. And when we eliminated that, we did stop immunizing against that. You know, when we got polio under control in some areas, we've been able to eliminate, you know, one of the types of polio that's in that vaccine. And even the flu vaccine, during the pandemic, we got rid of one type of influenza B. So instead of a quadrivalent flu vaccine, now everybody's getting a trivalent because we didn't need that other one. So I think people need to understand that from a policy standpoint, we're constantly looking at what's necessary and what's important. And whenever there's an opportunity to pull back, we certainly are willing to have those conversations. It's just premature to do that for many of these diseases that are still common and unfortunately can be potentially silent killers.
I've seen the argument that sometimes vaccines are victims of their own success. Hepatitis B kills globally 800,000 to a million people a year, a few thousand here in the U.S., but because so many people are vaccinated, it doesn't loom large as a problem. Does that sort of off-the-radar factor make people more likely to say, eh, maybe we don't need these anymore?
Yeah, great observation, Rob. You know, we call that the vaccine complacency problem, where when the disease becomes rare or at least doesn't get as much press, people kind of forget about the importance of continuing to maintain protection against it. You know, it's much like wearing a seatbelt. You know, 99% of the days you're in your car, there's no way you're going to have any kind of accident, but it's there when you need it if something unfortunate and unexpected happens. And that's sort of how vaccines provide protection, is they're there when you need them, and it's never known when that day is going to come. Again, you know, these are things that are safe and extraordinarily well studied. And, you know, we don't make these kinds of recommendations at a policy level lightly to give these kinds of products unless there's really clear benefit for every individual and for the communities.
Very briefly, Dr. Conway, a parent, expected parent, comes in, says, hey, I'm seeing these different guidelines. What do you recommend to that parent for hepatitis B vaccine for the newborn?
Yeah, I think every kid deserves this vaccine. It's still well deserved. It's still important. There's still a lot of unknowns out there about exposures to hepatitis B, and that can happen at any time in a child's life. And why not get them protection as soon as possible just to be able to prevent against the unexpected?
Dr. Conway, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Dr. Jim Conway is professor of pediatrics in the divisions of infectious diseases and global pediatrics at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He serves as medical director for UW Health Immunization Programs, been talking about changing federal recommendations on hepatitis B vaccines for infants.
Coming up, find out what's driving increases in the cost of house and condo insurance around the country and why Wisconsin is no exception.
What you'll hear in a lot of the national headlines are about states like Florida, states like Louisiana, places like California where you hear about hurricanes and wildfires, but it's absolutely true that premiums have increased a lot in Wisconsin as well.
That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. Last month, we received a message from Eric in Middleton.
The insurance we have for our condominium property here in the Madison area has increased over 400% this year over last year, and we could only find one vendor. What is the reason for this massive increase, and why are companies dropping condo insurance? What options do we have to reduce our costs?
When we looked into this, we found out that Eric is not alone. According to an analysis from the Wall Street Journal, home insurance rates in Wisconsin have increased by about 25% since January 2020. And throughout the country, they're rising even faster.
What's driving those costs for home and condo insurance? Philip Mulder is assistant professor of risk and insurance at UW-Madison. Philip, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you, Rob. Pleasure to be here.
Now, we're seeing insurance costs for houses, condos going up all over the country. Wisconsin, I understand, isn't the worst. It's still significant, though. What kind of things are we seeing when it comes to those costs here in the state?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you said, this is not an isolated phenomenon. It's happening nationally. And what you'll hear in a lot of the national headlines are about states like Florida, states like Louisiana, places like California where you hear about hurricanes and wildfires. But it's absolutely true that premiums have increased a lot in Wisconsin as well. Like, I've certainly seen this on my own homeowner's insurance bill in the last 2 years here in Madison.
We don't have hurricanes, happily. We don't so much have the wildfires in Wisconsin. We do have some disasters. What kind of things happen in the state that are at least a contributing factor to those costs in the state?
Absolutely. So, you know, in terms of the disaster risk itself, what most insurers operating in the state are going to be thinking about primarily is hail risk. So, you know, comes through, that can lead to roof-related claims. And then there's just all the things that can go wrong in a home that are covered, you know, burst water pipes, liability claims, things like that. One distinction, because it might be on a lot of people's minds, right, the recent flooding in Milwaukee was, of course, very significant. Flooding is, in fact, typically covered through separate policies. These are flood insurance policies. So your homeowner's insurance does not cover flood. If you want flood coverage, you're going to need to be shopping with the National Flood Insurance Program.
Now, people might be listening thinking, hang on, we've always had hail in Wisconsin and burst pipes and things like that. Why would the cost go up because of that? Are we at more risk because of things like climate change?
So there's a lot of different factors at play here, and this is something that my co-author and myself have been looking into in recent research. And, you know, when we kind of look at where premiums are going up and by how much, in terms of some of the climate signals that we're really getting on this issue, a lot of that does have to do with wildfire and hurricane risk. However, that's not to say that insurers aren't also thinking hard about how their losses are changing in Wisconsin and a lot of the uncertainty surrounding that. So what you've seen in our state is first, you know, you saw it happen over COVID, and while cost growth has slowed, it hasn't gone back down, is the increase in the cost of repairing and rebuilding homes. And that's going to be a major factor for insurers because just like it comes as a huge surprise to homeowners when you're learning how much it costs to say, you know, fix something around the house or put in a fence, that's the same cost that's getting passed through when you have, say, a hail claim on your roof.
You've mentioned, just before we started talking, you mentioned some research out there breaking it down county by county level. We're going to share that online at WPR.org. What do we see when we take that more granular view?
Yeah, absolutely. So that data, we're very proud of it. We released it just a few weeks ago, and this is what's informing our research. And, you know, in some cases, we can even drill down to the zip code level, but we've made available for every county from 2014 to 2024, you can see average annual homeowners insurance premiums that we've measured from a data set of over 70 million associated payments for people with mortgages. But at the end of the day, everywhere has gone up dramatically in the last 10 years. It's also interesting to compare us to our neighbors over in Minnesota. For whatever reason, you go from a county just on the Wisconsin side to just on the Minnesota side, and they're paying much more. Your state can really matter here because insurance is regulated at the state level.
Right. That regulation issue, some states are saying, okay, well, we're going to cap insurance price increases, double-edged sword. Maybe you keep the prices down, but the insurance companies say, well, maybe we won't do business in your state if you're going to cap our rates. How do you weigh that argument?
It's a fundamental trade-off that policymakers are ultimately going to have to deliberate because you've seen in some of the most extreme cases of this in California, they are having a lot of problem with some of the biggest insurers were not writing coverage anymore. And that's required these states to sort of put in place their own backed insurers to cover these folks. But then that risk is still ultimately falling on the state, right? Even if we keep the premium low, we create an alternative form of insurance. At the end of the day, if a home has a loss, someone's going to have to pay for it. In Wisconsin, we're lucky to not really have that as a fundamental problem. People tend to have their choice of insurers here and tend to be able to find coverage. But I think there's more to be done in terms of figuring out what is the right balance to strike.
Speaking of choices of coverage, we had an email from a listener that probably prompted this conversation saying, hey, our condo association's insurance prices went way up and we could only find one vendor. There was no shopping around. Are you worried that more communities will be in that situation where they might have had three or four options, they're down to one or two?
Yeah, it is hard because for an insurance market to work, it needs to be competitive. So this isn't to minimize at all, you know, the importance of having multiple players so that consumers can have choices so that you can find the best deal. Condos are a really tricky point in this market. And, you know, this is another one of those subtle distinctions is we're kind of looking at single family homes. There's this whole other market for condos. Another line of research we're looking into there, once again, you know, the focus is on Florida, where this has reached a total crisis point. And a lot of these condos can't find coverage at all. People can't get loans anymore because the buyers wouldn't be able to buy insurance or they can't get sufficient insurance. Once again, Wisconsin is not as bad as that, but we are seeing some of these effects play out because a condo is a huge liability to an insurer. And a lot of these buildings are aging and for insurers, they have to think twice about whether or not they want to take on that risk.
Now, people who rent might be listening saying, glad I don't have to worry about this. Hang on. Somebody owns that building and somebody has to insure that building, right?
That's right. So, you know, this is ultimately a cost that's being paid at the sort of market level, right? And ultimately, what's happening in terms of landlords' decisions is they're trying to decide whether to rent the home or sell the home. And they're making a calculation about how profitable it is to rent, given the cost that they have to pay. And if those costs go up, they either need to raise rents to maintain that level of profitability, or they're going to sell the home, and then that won't be a rental on the market anymore.
Philip, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Philip Mulder is an assistant professor of risk and insurance at UW-Madison. We talked to him about the drivers behind rising home insurance rates. Now, for a look at what this looks like on the ground and what options are out there for people facing the issue, we're joined by Michael Keener. He's owner of Keener Insurance Solutions, an independent insurance agency in Germantown. He served on the board of directors for the Professional Insurance Agents of Wisconsin for 6 years. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, as we just heard, the prices and the rate increases for insurance can vary from state to state, even county to county. What are you seeing in your neck of the woods in the Germantown area?
Yeah, I gotta say it's been a crazy couple of years from the insurance standpoint as an agent. The amount of remarketing that we've had to do. Let's go back a little bit. We'll go back about 3 to 5 years. And just reading an article I just pulled up on CBS News, homeowners insurance costs have shot up by 70% since 2021. So, I mean, this is just a trend that continues in the state of Wisconsin. And what's driving it? One of the number one key drivers behind that is really the increase in severe weather that we're having. We're having more hail, more severe storms. In the business, we categorize them as cat losses is what they call them. Any claim that pays out over $1 billion. And from the years of 1980 to 2021, we averaged one cat loss per year. We're up to 5 cat losses right now per year on average from 2020 to 2024. So that's really driven up the cost. Obviously, the severity of the claims is greater. And, you know, without continuing profitability or increase in premium coming in to the insurance companies, it's shrinking capacity. We've had several companies pull out of personal lines insurance over the last couple of years, just completely because their loss ratios are running so high that they needed to just get out of personal lines. They just didn't feel it, you know, they had the capability to be profitable. So we're seeing that. It's a really crazy time in the marketplace in insurance, home and condo insurance. Yeah, it's just really crazy what we're seeing right now.
So you are an independent insurer, so you can kind of compare and contrast different options, if I understand things right, for customers. Are you seeing people have that sense of sticker shock? Like, wow, this is a big increase. I don't know if I can afford homeownership even with this kind of insurance going up.
100%. Give you another example, myself. I bought a house over in the Sussex area. It was about 5 years ago, and my homeowner's rate was about $1,400 a year. I'm now up to, you know, 5 years later, I'm paying around $2,800 a year for my homeowner's insurance. And another thing on top of that is the deductibles. You know, the insurance companies are requiring much higher wind and hail deductibles. You know, certainly in Wisconsin, we have a lot of storms in the spring, a lot of wind, a lot of hail. So that's, you know, something that is really driving up that cost. So insurance companies are requiring higher deductibles. That's very common in the marketplace right now. We're seeing anywhere from a 1% of your total dwelling limit, up to $5,000. So insurance companies are getting out of the roof maintenance business. And it's just something that we're going to continue to see. Insurance companies are tightening up their underwriting as well. So, you know, they're being very cautious of what they're writing, and you just got to make sure that you're taking good care of your property and doing all the things to keep those costs down.
Now, if you want to own a home or have a mortgage, you pretty much need insurance. What's your advice for people who are, you know, seeing these prices go up? Is there any kind of shopping around they can do?
You bring up a really, really good point. So, you know, there's a couple different ways that people buy insurance products. And one is an independent agent and another is typically through direct writers. And as an independent agent, I have contracts with roughly 20 plus personal lines, preferred insurance companies. So when somebody contacts us, we have the ability to go out into the marketplace. We use comparative rating tools that look at all the different insurance companies that we work with. And this is the best part about it, is that we do still have competition in home and condo insurance. In the health insurance marketplace, place with everything that's going on there. There's just not competition right now like there should be, and that continues to drive up the cost of health insurance. So on the home and auto side, you know, we do have a lot of competition. We have a lot of great companies. There's hundreds out there, and I would recommend to people that they do take a look every few years and make sure that they are getting the best coverage and the best price.
Michael, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much. You have a great day.
Michael Keener is on the board of directors for the Professional Insurance Agents of Wisconsin. He's owner of Keener Insurance Solutions in Germantown. We talked to him about rising home and condo insurance costs in Wisconsin and how to deal with it. We also heard from Philip Mulder, assistant professor of risk and insurance at UW-Madison, talking about the drivers behind those increases.
Still to come, about 1 in 4 school-age students struggle to afford period products. In Wisconsin, a group aims to put free menstrual products in schools and community spaces. That work of the Monthlies Project is coming up next.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In the U.S., 39% of teens feel unable to do their best schoolwork due to the lack of access to period products. That's according to the global nonprofit called Period that works to reduce what's known as period poverty and the stigma around it.
The lack of access to products like pads and tampons can lead students to miss school and feel shame about menstruating.
Here in Wisconsin, a community initiative called the Monthlies Project is working on this issue.
The group, which started in Appleton 3 years ago, provides free menstrual products for schools and community spaces. They've partnered with dozens of schools in the northeastern part of the state and recently expanded into the Oshkosh area.
Julie Keller serves on the Monthlies Project steering committee called the Regulars. Julie, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Well, start out with the situation in our state. How prevalent is period poverty across Wisconsin?
Yeah, period poverty is something that we don't really think about being an issue in Wisconsin or even in the United States. But national data shows that 1 in 5 teens do not have access to period products when they need it, and that 84% of teens either have missed a day of school or know somebody who has missed school because they do not have access to period products. So I think it's an issue that we often don't talk about, and we often don't even realize it's an issue here in Wisconsin until you kind of put it out there and start talking to folks and you realize how prevalent it really is.
Mm. And then the Monthlies Project, it recently expanded into the Oshkosh area, providing menstrual products to schools and to community centers. How does the project work with local schools and districts? How do you get your foot in the door?
Yeah, so we started this project in the Fox Valley area in 2022. It's really a community initiative to provide menstrual health products to school-age students and also to bring the awareness of period poverty and really focus in on the educational inequality that period poverty brings to the folks who menstruate in our schools. So this really came about because we know that this is an issue, and we have a group of people who basically came together and said, what can we do and how can we solve this issue or address this issue in our community? And so my day job is with the Women's Fund for the Fox Valley Region, and we are the vehicle to accept donations into the project as well as make grants out for the project to supply schools with the period products. And Feeding America of Eastern Wisconsin is another big partner, and they are able to procure products at a really reasonable rate, less than you or I could if we went to a big box store to buy them. And then they also have this vast distribution network, and they are able to help distribute the products to all the schools. So what the schools do is they actually apply for product. Mm-hmm. They don't apply for money to buy the product, again, because we can get so much more better bang for our buck if we have Feeding America do that for us, and they can buy pallets of products at a time.
Wow.
So the schools provide the products. They go online to our website. They fill out a quick application, and then we work work with them on what products they need, how much they need, what kinds of products they need for their school. And then we work with them to make sure the products get there. And then once the products get there, the schools are responsible for distributing the products. We always want to have the products be available when and where the menstruators need it. So we really encourage them, just put them in the bathrooms, and then they're right there for them when they need them.
How expensive are products like tampons and pads, and how does that impact someone's ability to get access to these products?
Unfortunately, they are very expensive, and we estimated that it's about $13.25 a month that a menstruator would spend on products, which it doesn't sound like a lot of money, but for people who don't have any extra money at the end of the month, that's a barrier for them. So it is relatively expensive for folks to provide those products. And then if you're in a household with more than one menstruator, you know, you multiply that number by how many people are in the house and need those products. And it really begins to add up very, very quickly. So this is a way for us to address that issue of access, because programs such as SNAP or WIC, some of those government programs, you are not allowed to buy period products with that subsidy you may get for food. So you still are, at the end of the month, are stuck with trying to figure out how to buy period products because you have no other resources for it.
There have been a number of bills introduced in Wisconsin that would exempt period products from sales tax. What do you make of the policy issue side of this and, you know, these bills that have not been able to become law?
Yeah, it's really been quite frustrating because we have seen so many states. In fact, right now we're at 32 states that do not tax period products. And those are all different types of states, blue states, red states, purple states. So it is a nonpartisan issue. And it's a little frustrating that Wisconsin hasn't quite been able to get there yet. An organization called Period Law, which is a national organization, actually heard about us and reached out because their mission is to work with all of the states to get these products exempt from tax. And so we have worked with them. We have worked with some of our local legislators to try to get this into the budget and not have them be taxed. You know, we're one of 18 states, so we're in the minority on this issue. And I hope with us continuing to work on it, continuing to raise the issue about it, that we'll eventually see Wisconsin move over to the majority on this.
And from what I understand, our neighbor Minnesota already requires schools to carry these free products. Is that right?
Yes, they did. I believe that was last year that they passed legislation that schools, I think it's grade 4 through 12, they have to provide period products to the schools for grades 4 through 12. Mm-hmm. And that is something that just really, if you think about it, it just makes a lot of sense. You know, there's not a lot of other hygiene products that we ask our students to provide in schools. You know, we're not asking them to provide their own toilet paper, their own soap, their own paper towels, you know, all these hygiene products that you need. We're not asking students to provide those, but menstrual products, we are asking them to provide.
You're also working on the stigma around this issue, Julie Keller, and I'm wondering what you're doing to try to make, you know, people not associate negative, you know, associations with periods? And why is there the continued stigma around menstruation?
Yeah, that's a tough question. I don't know why there's this continued stigma. And it's something that we are really working hard to overcome because we want to have this be a conversation that we all have. It's part of life. It's what happens every month for a whole lot of people for a good portion of their life. And to be embarrassed by it or not have the products you need and have to struggle that way, that's just not fair to half the population. And so we try to. That's one reason why we encourage schools to put them out there, to be very public about it, to say that they're available. You shouldn't have to whisper and ask and be discreet about it. If you need period products, they should be available to you. And also with the Monthlies Project, we wanted to try to decrease that stigma. So we just have a lot of fun with it. We have a lot of fun with the puns that we use. We have a lot of fun with just talking about it and really just being out there and saying, we're going to be bold about this and we're going to be talking about this and nobody needs to be embarrassed at all. Because like I said, it's just part of life.
Julie, how do you see the Monthlies Project growing in the future in Wisconsin? And do you have tips for other communities in Wisconsin that want to launch a project like this?
Yes, absolutely. So we started, as I said, just really in the Fox Valley area, Appleton, and the surrounding communities. Then we were getting requests from the Green Bay area. So we expanded to the Green Bay area and Brown County area as well. And then, as we said at the beginning, just recently, the Oshkosh community has gotten involved as well. So it's really a great model that a lot of communities can use because it's not setting up another nonprofit, you know, with staff and overhead. It's really all about just using the resources in the community that you already have. So we do receive requests from all over the state asking us if we can help them supply products to their schools. We've even received requests from outside of the state. They say they just Google us and they find us. So really, when we get requests from folks that are outside of our kind of where we are right now, we encourage them to reach out to if they have a Women's Fund, if they have United Way, if Feeding America or another food bank covers their community, that could be a way that they could get something like this started. And we are more than happy to work with anybody who is interested in doing this. That's really how Oshkosh came to be, is we just worked with the Women's Fund there and set it up and modeled it after what we did here. And they just started, and it's really exciting to see the project expand.
Julie, thank you for your work. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having us and raising this issue for our community and our state.
Julie Keller serves on the Monthlies Project Steering Committee called The Regulars. The group partners with schools and community centers to provide free menstrual products, and they recently expanded into the Oshkosh School District. Wisconsin Today producers include Royce Padeswa, Beatrice Lawrence, and Mackenzie Crummy.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Thanks for listening to WPR News.